Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Look Ahead podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining me today, as he does every Monday, is my good friend Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners for a look at the week ahead and discuss whatever else is on his mind. Byron, welcome back and hope you guys had a terrific weekend.
It was an interesting weekend, but I'm glad it's over.
Well, I hope it wasn't too bad. So I'm very glad you're joining us, and I hope the rest of the week goes well. Before we get started, HII is one of the largest artificial intelligence and machine learning federal contractors to the U.S. government. HII delivering the advantage. Byron, a lot of great notes on your part over the past week, but want to start with Congress and its debate on funding futures. We discussed that on Friday's program a little bit, and you wrote about it in your note today. Walk us through your thesis, what your concerns are, and where you think we'll end up.
Michael kind of walked through, you know, the timing for the House Armed Services Committee markup of the National Defense Authorization Act. You know, that's broadly comported with what I've been hearing too. And then obviously the Senate will follow in June. You know, what I wrote about is, I suppose optimistically, let's just talk about the NDAA first. That conceivably could be completed in September. You know, it's fairly rare to see one of these done in August. There was a table that I showed in my note that looked at the last 25 fiscal years of NDAAs and when they were enacted. And, you know, most of them, I think the count was 11, are actually enacted in December. So we'll just see. I mean, I think the timing and pacing seems fairly normal. I suppose the real key is going to be, you know, policy riders and what is attempted to be hung onto the NDAA that might make it a little bit more controversial. And that's something that could push this off a bit. But I think it's pretty safe to say that this will get done by December. Appropriations were kind of a little bit more interesting, and it kind of dovetails with the NDAA, because I think, well, I know during the April 30th oversight hearing that House Armed Services Committee held, Chairman Rogers said that, you know, kind of what you see is what you get, that they are going to abide by the caps. In other words, the $895 billion in discretionary spending for defense that was set by the Fiscal Responsibility Act. And then you had Senator Murray come out, I believe, on the 2nd, basically saying, you know, look, we're going for parity. You know, if people want to raise defense, we're going to raise non-defense too. So I think both those parameters, at least, that's kind of laying down the gauntlet that, you know, if you want to have a budget battle, we'll have a budget battle. But at the same time, if you want to stick within the confines of the numbers that were set by the Fiscal Responsibility Act, you know, that also could bode for somewhat timely conclusion to the appropriations bills, because there are really two. There's one for defense, then one for military construction and veterans. But, you know, I think maybe that also could get done in a lame duck session of Congress, although, you know, if the election looks like it's a real blowout on either side, I suppose, you know, people want to wait until the 119th Congress, and then they can change defense or non-defense to their liking. So, you know, but the bottom line is, it just doesn't sound like there's a lot of wiggle room around that defense number. So as much as there might be an interest in increasing it, you know, at least you had two leaders in Congress say, not so fast. I think raising non-defense in an election year, you know, might be popular in some quarters, but get some pushback from Republicans as well. So I think, you know, again, Vago, there's always a little bit of leeway. Congress makes changes to these budget requests, actually quite a large number of them that are fairly minor if you go through the bill reports. But, you know, the idea that you're going to see tens of billions of dollars added to defense, don't count on it. You know, at the same hand, you know, we're not in an environment where I think you're going to see a cut to defense spending.
Right.
So it's what you see is what you get.
Let me, which is a great line. Well, just real quick, what are potentially the most controversial aspects of this do you that you think is going to be problematic in the process?
Well, I think, the summary that we're still wading through oversight hearings, but listening and reading through the transcripts on some that occurred over the last couple of weeks, the request for one submarine, as much as I think the DoD laid out the argument why they were doing that, I think just cosmetically and optically, although I believe it was Representative Courtney made a point during one of the hearings on no, there's actually a more impact on the submarine industrial base by just doing one in FY25 instead of two. So that's going to be a pressure point. But that's something that in theory could be handled with rescissions to money that had been appropriated in prior years but not yet obligated. The F-35 has caught a little bit of flack, but that's not new or unusual to me. And the Sentinel program was the other one that I think, we'll really have to see what the DoD says in July. I mean, I don't think they're going to back off of it, but, is there a new cost estimate? It doesn't seem to be so much the missile, but a couple of witnesses made the point this is one of the largest civil works projects the DoD has undertaken really since the
Exactly.
1860s.
Yeah, I mean it's an extraordinary program, right? I mean you're dealing with everything from a new missile to the electronics, to the command and control systems, to the real estate, and you can't pull. You know what I mean? This isn't one of those things where you're going to take missiles offline. You're going to have to get new real estate to build the missiles, and then go into a decommissioning phase and a phase transfer. I mean it's really quite a really quite an incredible program that was bid. Unfortunately,
Well, like a lot of things, yeah, a lot of things were bid without an understanding about, what kind of inflationary environment we might be in. So
exactly.
that's not unusual. And it's also, I think Secretary Kendall's made the point that, when you haven't done this type of project in 40 years, you lose a little bit of muscle memory as to how to estimate these things. So that may be another factor. But again, Vago, I think, is Congress going to cut the Sentinel program? No. Are they going to slash F-35? No. So I think it's inevitable, that's what these hearings are for. They're oversight hearings. And but the budget, is going to operate in a fairly narrow lane here.
Let's take the discussion to the Green Book, a very important document every year from the Office of the Undersecretary for or the Pentagon Comptroller, and it gives budget trend information going back literally to World War II and future year projections. You characterized it as a bit of a mess. And Dov Zakheim on Friday didn't exactly disagree with you on that. No disrespect intended to Mike McCord, who's a terrific professional, and the team over there. Walk us through why you concluded it was a mess and what
Well, the
you found
part that
most
made it messy,
problematic.
Bago, is you had it was released. I would have rather had the Comptroller's office release this in mid-June when they can incorporate the security supplementals and the FY24 appropriations into the book. So, if you looked at the outlay estimates, and this gets into fairly wonky material, but analysts do use this material in the justification books to look at outlays. And so if the outlay estimates are off, and don't really reflect, the latest bit of legislation, we kind of have to sharpen our own pencils and make our own estimates. But it would be nice. That to me was the messy part of the budget justification. But the format is pretty set every year. It is a very valuable resource. My only point is, it was released before, right before, or I should say, right, it was released right after those two pieces of legislation were completed, and it would have been nice to have a budget justification book. Not a green book, I'm sorry. It would be nice to have a green book that reflected those major pieces of legislation.
You dissect the Green Book, though, and it is good not just for right, top line defense trends, but also each of the individual services and their, abundant subcategories. Anything jump out at you in reviewing all the documentation?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I look at, as much as people look at, oh, here are the latest forecasts, and you get a little bit of that when OMB releases, kind of the 10-year plan when the budget is released. But what the Green Book does, it aggregates everything that's in the budget justification books, and so you can see these subcategories like how did Army aircraft do, or how did Army weapon and tracked combat vehicles do. So you can parse that data out. And what I did in an analysis was just look at, okay, what were the changes from the year ago plan? Because we had that data for fiscal year 25 through 28. And with the FY25 budget submission, we now knew the request. But then what adjustments DoD made to its plan for 26, 27, and 28. And I think, no surprise, we kind of knew this from the OMB numbers, but the brunt of that $10 billion cut on the FY25 top line from the Fiscal Responsibility Act, the majority of that fell on the investment accounts. But what was really interesting was, some of the choices that were reflected in the changes internally. And, the Army, I think, as we well knew, they cut R&D T&E. Basically, I think a slug of that was from the FARA program that they repurposed back into Black Hawk and Chinook. There's a big jump in Navy shipbuilding that reflects the amphib money that got put back into the budget. And I think the Air Force number is a little tricky because it looked like there was a pretty significant cut in defense-wide RDT&E, but a big jump in Air Force RDT&E. And I honestly, Vaga, there is, I don't have a security clearance. So I don't know if that was a transfer that could partly explain some of that change from classified programs and defense-wide that got moved over to Air Force, or something else going on. But the increase in Air Force RDT&E was really pretty dramatic relative to last year's plan. At the same time, the cut in defense-wide RDT&E was pretty significant as well.
Was there any other sort of deeper trend data that you've picked up, right? I mean, this is a time of change. The department is looks like it is making some changes to the way that it's executing some programs. Obviously, things like collaborative combat aircraft will have sort of a downstream impact, both also in shaping sort of industrial outcomes. But was there, and you had the Army, for example, get rid of the future armed reconnaissance aircraft, saying, "Hey, we can do this mission in different sorts of ways, including with unmanned vehicles." Is there sort of a change in investment patterns that you're seeing here
No,
that
I
kind of
think
jump
what's
out at you?
interesting, it's kind of the services took in some ways their own routes here. And, as I said, maybe, the Army and the Air Force seemed to favor procurement in the out years, and the Air Force favored, at least the way the budget numbers work, they were more RDT&E intensive. Now within that RDT&E line, like I said, I don't know what classified programs are there, but that could explain some of that increase. And but I wouldn't, no, I don't have anything above me on that, Vago.
Byron, let me just real quick. Any earnings, sort of leftover earnings thoughts before we get to like future projects that you're working, and of course Frank Kendall's Air Force Secretary Kendall's amazing AI flight. But walk us through. I mean, were there any sort of residual messages that you spotted, or trends, or things you found interesting after earnings wrapped up?
No, I mean, Vago, some of the reactions to individual earnings reports are still, they can be all over the map. Leidos had a pretty good quarter. Great. I thought the HAI numbers were okay, but the stock got punished. And but those are markets, and I'm not always sure, what triggers, if this is an algorithm or something that really fundamentally changed in an outlook. I would say, you know, just stepping back, big picture, I still have to complete this analysis, but you know, broadly, the operating margins in these businesses are still fairly stable. I suppose that's a good thing. You know, there are always going to be little variations, but you know, Curtiss-Wright, for example, their defense electronics business, okay, they reported a margin was up from the year ago quarter, but kind of in line with the last three quarters. So there's nothing where you go like, there's a breakout going on here. And you know, I'll say it again. I mean, I think the relative absence of change to guidance, at least related to the security supplementals, is noteworthy. And I think it's just still a lot of people kind of scratching their heads about, well, those are big numbers, but you know, how they're going to flow through and what's an O&M and what's going to get transferred to procurement. So that was just another feature of these earnings reports last week. There's still a handful to go, but you know, for all intents and purposes, this earnings season is pretty much over.
So, what are some of the projects, right, that you're going to focus on that folks are going to hear about in the next couple of weeks?
Well, I still want to. I've got to update my defense primer. I do that every year, with the budget, with the numbers from the Green Book. But as I said, I've got to make some of my own adjustments on outlays. I just don't want to take what's in the Green Book and publish that without acknowledging the security supplemental and the FY24 final appropriations. I do want to, so I'll probably get that done in June, the way this thing usually rolls out. I want to spend a little bit more time thinking about company strategies here. And, you know, it really was kind of prompted by something I wrote about. You know, the innovator's dilemma and kind of how companies were reacting to things like CCA or, you know, Kath Hicks' announcement on Replicator, you know, that one of the initial tranche, the initial award is going to AeroVironment. I mean, I think there is a lot going on strategically in this segment, and it's worthwhile to just sit back and kind of parse through. You know, can I discern? Can I look at different strategies? We've talked about HAI, for example, you know, which showcased what they were trying to do at their investor day. But you know, this business doesn't stand still, but I think it's just worth putting a little bit of gray matter to that particular problem set. I want to come back and look at the Russia-Ukraine war. You know, what's going on? What are we learning from it? You know, there were some interesting reports, not necessarily, this was probably 2 weeks ago, you know, the number of M1s, for example, that Ukraine had lost, the, you know, I think it was five or six to Russian drone strikes. So that's kind of pointed to a vulnerability in that particular armored vehicle. And my understanding, the Ukrainians, at least according to the press reports, had pulled those tanks back. What does that mean? You know, what, how quick can the army and the other military services get on this counter UAS problem? Because it's a big one, and it's certainly going to be a global phenomenon, as we've seen really around the world in the conflicts that have been ongoing in 2024. And then the final thought was just a project to kind of take a look at these prior periods in time where industry has been reluctant to spend money ahead of need. And, you know, how did that get solved? You know, did it matter? I mean, were companies rewarded who kind of leaped ahead and invested their own money and then had a solution that the DoD could apply? Or, you know, if there really was this reticence to expand capacity without firm contracts, you know, how is that eventually rectified? So it's more of a historic look, but I do think history can provide some pretty good insight into where some of these current debates stand and what DoD and what contractors ought to be doing about that.
And your reminder to the audience to check out Clay Christensen, right? Reacquaint yourself with Is still an incredible work. Speaking of history, Frank Kendall made history as the Air Force Secretary to be the first to fly a senior leader to fly on an AI-powered aircraft and go through air combat maneuvering at 5G. And all accounts are that he, both enjoyed the flight, but also learned a lot from it. And we hope to talk to him about that as well soon. What's that and many other things, we hope. What jumped out at you?
It's fascinating. That's what leadership is all about. I mean, that's what leaders do to change an organization. It's like, hey, if I can do it, Frank's not a 28-year-old Air Force Academy grad. Frank's been around for a while, and I think just the fact that he was willing to get into that and show that this stuff works. That's a very profound and important message. At the time, he is trying to pull through things like CCA, and which I'm sure, anytime there's change, you're going to get pushback on it. When you mentioned that, Vago, I was thinking, I heard a former DoD leader recently in a presentation who showed, Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill. And he said, yeah, that's kind of DoD acquisition. What he didn't show is usually there are people on the other side of the rock that are trying to push it back down the hill. So, anything you can do to remove that pressure from getting the rock up the hill, I really commend the secretary for taking that step.
Well, I should also point out that Secretary Kendall is a distinguished West Point grad, class of 71, that chairman, his classmate was Chairman Reed. And like you, he is a very avid and long-range sailor. So he's somebody who's in actually, I think, some pretty good shape. So it's not like they were jamming a tub of goo in there and
Oh no, I didn't
driving
mean
it
to
across
imply
the
that.
sky.
Yeah, I would never say the secretary is a tub of goo. Good.
No, yeah, thank goodness.
No.
Yes, let the record show, Mr. Secretary. We don't look at you that way at all. Let's move on from this and talk a little bit about the week ahead. Byron, walk us through what the audience ought to be paying attention to and what you're going to be paying attention to.
Well, look, there's still oversight hearings. Senior DoD leadership is going to be for the Senate Appropriations Defense Subcommittee. And then Senate Armed Services Committee is holding hearings on the Air Force request and another on missile defense. There are a number of conferences, Vago, this week that I think are kind of interesting. GEOINT started today and Monday. That's Geospatial Intelligence Exhibition Symposium down in Florida. There's a fire symposium, which is basically artillery and air defense artillery in Lawton, Oklahoma. That's running in person and I think also virtually too. RSA, which is a major cybersecurity conference, is running in San Francisco this week. There's the 21st Annual Acquisition Research Symposium at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. That usually, if you want to get in the weeds on acquisition issues, that's a pretty interesting conference to at least listen to and see what the papers are presented at. There's an AI expo being held May 7th and 8th by the Special Competitive Studies Project. Ranking Member Smith is speaking at an AEI event on kind of this Eurasian triangle that's developed between China, Russia, Iran, and I suppose really a square because North Korea's got to be included on it as well. And then the one thing I just want to put this out there is Victory Day is something that Russia observes on May 9th to commemorate the end of the war in 1945 with Germany. So, if there's a geopolitical flashpoint, people are probably going to be focusing on what's going to happen in Rafah, if anything, this week. But that Victory Day, I think the Russians should, I would expect they'll try something symbolic against Ukraine on that day.
Yeah, you pointed out that both sides will want to get a zinger in, probably, and indeed the Russians are trying to move as quickly as they can to score some points before that U.S. more U.S. Aid arrives in the country that's needed. I mean, it's astonishing how the Ukrainians have lost territory, but they have not lost as much territory as people thought, at least thus far. Does it surprise you that Putin is again reaching for the nuclear lever, right in the wake of Macron saying troops will be necessary. And so now giving a directive for tactical nuclear forces to
No,
exercise.
I mean, we didn't tell the other thing, I guess, obviously, is, Xi Jinping is in France today, and then he's going to be in Serbia, and well, I guess tomorrow, day after tomorrow, and then in Hungary. I think that's interesting. His longest stay is going to be in Hungary, so that's another geopolitical element to watch. But Putin can, I will worry about. If Putin starts testing nuclear weapons, then I'm going to get pretty alarmed. But the saber rattling, I'm not surprised by it, but I think it's just that for now.
Well, I mean, one other way of looking at this is, I mean, if he's going to test a nuclear weapon, we have nuclear weapons too. I mean,
Of course.
you just cannot allow a thug to hide behind the threat of nuclear weapons and muscle us around. And like, as grateful as I am for the administration and ultimately the calls, the president and his team, I think they've been too cowed by unfortunately that threat. Let me just one last quick question. What did you make of the threat briefing last week with Avril Haines and Lieutenant General Cruz, who kind of gave a briefing on sort of the threats facing the nation? I thought it was a terrific discussion about what the Chinese are up to, what the Russians are up to, and actually the threat that they constitute. And as you pointed out, as I think we've been talking about a lot on our platform, has been it's really important to see these four together as opposed to, individual threats. Is there anything
Well,
that
it's
you
all of the above, Vogel. I mean, this kind of gets back to the strategy question I was mentioning earlier. I think for contractors, there are two thoughts. One is, look, great power competition is it's unpredictable, and it can span the entire range of a conflict spectrum. I mean, there's also this report that there was concern about more Russian sabotage operations in Europe. So, this idea that it's just about Taiwan and a high-end aerospace naval battle, it's going to extend through the entire spectrum of conflict. And that to me, from a contractor standpoint, you probably don't want to have all your eggs in one or two baskets here. I think it's going to, and there are some systems. I mean, when you get into the surveillance data, low cost strike, all those things are going to matter in this the struggle.
Byron, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Always a pleasure. Hope you have a terrific week and look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Vaga. Safe travels.
And a special thanks to all of you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. We'll be back again tomorrow with the 17th Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force, retired United States Air Force General Dave Goldfein, to talk on our APEX series about innovation. Don't miss that program. It's going to be fascinating. Thanks very much again for joining us. We'll see you again tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.